Thus have I heard. 2,500 years ago, in northern India, there lived a young man of the Gotama clan. We actually don't really know his first name. He's called Siddhartha Gotama, but that name doesn't show up till about a half a millennia later. He's just referred to as the ascetic Gotama or Mr. Gotama. But we'll call him Siddhartha because that's the traditional name. Siddhartha Gotama was the son of the elected leader of the Sakyans. The Sakyans were a warlike tribe. They were Katyas, warriors, who lived in northern India and apparently had a democratic republic. Siddhartha Gotama was troubled by what he saw there. When you think of India, probably the image that doesn't come to mind is Mexico or Colombia, a real macho culture. But from the hints that we find in the suttas, the Buddha's discourses, one of the major reasons he left home to seek his spiritual fortune was because people were always quarreling and arguing. When he was 29 years old, he left a very good setup, a place where he was probably on track to be the next elected leader, and headed south to the Ganges River Valley to seek his spiritual fortune. India at that time had achieved enough efficiency with its agriculture that it could actually support people who weren't engaged in farming. People like full-time spiritual seekers. There was a surplus of food to feed them. There was also a surplus of food to feed standing armies. You win some, you lose some. And the Ganges River Valley was literally crawling with spiritual seekers. They practiced a huge number of different practices. Siddhartha Gotama headed to the southeast, to the land of the Kalamas. And there he studied with a teacher known as Alara Kalama. And he learned Alara Kalama's doctrine. And he also learned his meditation practice, which culminated in the realm of nothingness, nothingness, what we call today the seventh jhana. Siddhartha Gotama was very skilled at the practice, and eventually his teacher said to him, "You know what I know. I know what you know. Come, let us lead this group together." But Siddhartha Gotama was more worried about the dukkha of life, the unpleasantness, the unsatisfactoriness, the suffering. And all he'd learned was seven jhanas, so he left. And he continued heading to the southeast, and eventually came to the country of Magadha. And there he studied with Uddaka Ramaputta, Uddaka the son of Rama. Rama had apparently been a spiritual teacher who had died, and this was his successor, maybe his biological son, but certainly his spiritual son. And Siddhartha Gotama studied with Uddaka Ramaputta, and he learned Rama's doctrine, and he learned Rama's meditation practice, which took him to the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, what we call the eighth jhana. And Uddaka was very impressed. He said, "You know Rama's doctrine and practices as well as Rama did, and you should lead this group." But Siddhartha Gautama wanted to know what to do about dukkha, and all he'd learned was the eighth jhana. So he left. He began practicing what we would call severe austerities. He practiced the breathless meditation. Apparently, he would hold his breath for as long as he could. And what he discovered was that if you spend a lot of time holding your breath for as long as you can, it gives you very bad headaches. But that's all he learned. So he gave up that meditation, and he began practicing eating very little food. He eventually was living on 1 grain of rice a day. And after some time of practicing that, what he had discovered was that if you eat 1 grain of rice a day, you get very skinny and have a tendency to fall over. Again, this had not provided the answer he was looking for. When he had been living at home, he had indulged in all sorts of sensuous pleasures, which didn't provide the answer. Now he had tried the opposite, the severe austerities, and they too didn't provide the answer he was seeking. And he began to think, maybe there's some other practice he could undertake. While reflecting on what he could possibly do, he remembered an incident from his childhood when his father was working. And he was seated in the shade of a rose apple tree and stumbled into the first jhana. And now, some quarter century later, he remembers this incident and reflects that the pleasure he experienced in the first jhana was not sensual pleasure. It was pleasure without any taint or corruption associated with it. And he thought, why should I be afraid of pleasure that's not sensual pleasure? I'm not afraid of that kind of pleasure. And then he thought more, and he wondered, could these jhanas be the way to awakening? And the more he thought about it, the more he realized, yes, this is the way to awakening. He also realized that in his very weakened state, he was not fit for much of anything, let alone jhana practice. So he began eating regular food. Now, at that time, there were 5 other ascetics who had been practicing with him, and they figured that when he learned something important, he would tell them. But those 5 ascetics saw Siddhartha Gautama eating real food, and they thought he'd given up the spiritual life, that he had resorted to the life of luxury. And they left in disgust. But Siddhartha Gautama had not given up the spiritual life. He was just trying to find something that worked. After he had regained his strength, and we have no idea how long that took, he decided one full moon night that he was going to sit under this tree until either the flesh rotted from his bones or he figured out what to do about dukkha. He started off that night stepping through the jhanas, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then with his mind concentrated, bright, clear, sharp, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, he directed and inclined it to remembering past lives. That's how he spent the first watch of the night. 3 watches of the night, 12 hours long, so 4 hours, practicing jhanas and remembering past lives. And then in the second watch of the night, with his mind concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, he directed and inclined it to seeing beings passing away and re-arising according to their karma. And then in the third watch of the night, with his mind concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, he was able to formulate what we now know as the Four Noble Truths. Actually, should probably be better translated as the Four Ennobling Truths. It's not that the truths themselves are noble, but coming to deeply understand these truths will ennoble one, will allow one to wake up, which is what happened to Siddhartha Gautama. When the sun came up the next morning, he was a changed man. He was awake, enlightened. It says he spent the next 7 weeks in the neighborhood of this tree, the Bodhi tree, trying to figure out, could he teach this? He did spend some time simply enjoying the bliss of awakening. But eventually he thought, maybe he could teach this. Well, maybe not, because what he had seen was, it was difficult. He had come across what we now call dependent origination. And in thinking about the people of his time, he felt that they were addicted to their lifestyle, their pursuit of pleasures. For someone addicted to their lifestyle, it would be very difficult to see this very subtle teaching of dependent origination. For someone addicted to their lifestyle, it would be quite difficult to let go of all the nice features of that lifestyle, to see the cessation of concocting and fabricating, to give up craving, to become awakened. And so his mind was not inclined to teach. The discourses say at that point, one of the highest of the Brahma gods recognized that the newly awakened Buddha was not inclined to teach and thought, oh, the world will be lost. So as quickly as a strong man could extend his arm or draw it back, that Brahma god disappeared from the highest of the heavens and reappeared on earth. And he got down before the newly awakened Buddha, got down on one knee, put his hands in reverential salutation, and begged the Buddha to teach for the benefit of gods and humans. He said, there are some with little dust in their eyes. They will understand what you have come to understand. And then the Buddha thought about it. And yes, perhaps indeed there were some with little dust in their eyes. Perhaps they would understand what he had come to understand. And so he thought, maybe I should try teaching. And then that Brahma god, upon realizing that the Buddha was going to teach, as quickly as a strong man could extend his arm or draw it back, disappeared from the human realm and reappeared in the highest of the heavens. The Buddha thought, now who should I teach? Who do I know that has little dust in their eyes? And he remembered his first teacher, Alara Kalama. He thought, Alara Kalama has little dust in his eyes. But unfortunately, Alara Kalama had recently died. Then he thought about Udaka Ramaputta, his second teacher. Udaka Ramaputta has little dust in his eyes, but he too had recently died. Then he thought about his five friends, the ones that had left him because they thought he'd given up the spiritual path. And he thought, these five, they too have little dust in their eyes. Perhaps I should try and teach them. So with the eye of a Buddha, he was able to survey the world and see that they had headed west to near the great city of Varanasi, to the deer park outside of the town of Sarnath. And so he set out walking in that direction. Along the way, he encountered an ajivaka, a member of a different religious tradition. And this ajivaka was very impressed with the Buddha's appearance. He said, "Your appearance is not like ordinary men. Your features are very clear. Who is your teacher?" The Buddha said, "I have no teacher. I'm awake." And the ajivaka said, "Well, good for you," and passed by on the other side. The Buddha's first attempt at teaching didn't go over really well. But he persisted, and he headed on west till he got near to the great city of Varanasi. And he went out to the village of Sarnath, to the deer park at Isipatana. And his five friends saw him coming in the distance. And they said, "Oh, look, it's Sid the Slacker. We will let him sit with us, but we won't show him any reverence. I mean, he's given up the spiritual path." But when the Buddha drew near, they were unable to resist going and taking his robe and bowl and preparing a seat and getting water so he could wash his feet. And after he had washed his feet, he said to them, "Well, guys, I figured it out." And they laughed and they said, "You didn't figure nothing out. We saw you. You were eaten. You gave up the spiritual path." And he said, No, I really did figure it out." And they said, "You've resorted to the life of luxury. You can't figure anything out being luxurious like that." And he said, "No, guys, I really did figure it out. I have not resorted to the life of luxury. I've just found the middle way. Have I ever talked to you like this before? Have I ever claimed to have figured it out before in all the years you've known me?" Well, they had to admit he'd never claimed to have figured it out, so they agreed to listen to what he had to say. And what he taught them is what we know as the discourse setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma, the Dhamma Chakra Pavadana Sutta. And in that discourse, he taught them the Four Noble Truths, the Four Ennobling Truths, and the Eightfold Path. The first of these ennobling truths is dukkha happens. Everybody know the word dukkha? It usually gets translated as suffering. It's true, all suffering is dukkha, but dukkha has a broader meaning. Sometimes you see it translated as unsatisfactoriness. That's better. Unpleasantness. Stress. As an old hippie, I like to translate it as bummer. That really captures what's going on. You see, a bummer is something that bums you out. But it's you who's getting bummed out. It's not the external circumstance. It's your reaction to some experience. And this is what dukkha is about. But since there's no really good English word that captures all the nuances of dukkha, I tend to want to leave it untranslated. And I don't think you have a good word in Finnish even that captures all the nuances of dukkha. Not only does dukkha mean bummer and unsatisfactoriness and suffering, it also means that nothing is a source of lasting happiness. I mean, this is a nice bell, right? It's got a nice tone, nice little striker. It's not suffering. It's not unsatisfactory. But it's not a source of lasting happiness. And supper was quite nice, but it's also not a source of lasting happiness. So dukkha has all these shades of meaning, and so I'll leave it untranslated. But the Buddha was wise enough to see that dukkha is the problem. That's the general underlying problem. All the other things, like not having a BMW, or maybe in his case, not having a white elephant, that wasn't the real problem. The real problem was the unsatisfactory nature of not having what you wanted, or the unsatisfactory nature of having what you didn't want. But the Buddha didn't stop by just pointing out that there's a lot of unsatisfactoriness in life, a lot of dukkha. He said that dukkha arises dependent upon craving. That this craving is a necessary condition for the arising of dukkha. And that craving could be of three types. Craving for sense pleasures, craving for becoming, and craving for not becoming. The craving for sense pleasures is pretty obvious. We like to see pleasant sights. We like to hear nice sounds. We like to smell nice smells, taste nice food, touch nice textures, and we like to think pleasant thoughts, have happy emotions. This is sense pleasures. And if we're craving those things, then it might lead to dukkha. The craving for becoming can either be becoming in this world. I want to become rich and famous, or I want to become a doctor, or I want to become whatever. Or it can be craving for becoming in the next world. I want to have a good rebirth. I want to be born in one of the heavenly realms. Determining your next rebirth was a popular thing to do in the culture that the Buddha lived in. And you undertook spiritual practices quite often with that goal in mind of becoming something in your next life. There's also the craving for not becoming. This can be suicide, but it can also be the escape. You drink so much alcohol that you basically don't become. You become obliterated. So you've sort of stopped dealing with whatever your problems are and escape into oblivion. So that's a form of craving for not becoming. But there were also spiritual traditions at the time of the Buddha who thought it was a really bad idea to have a next life. And so they were craving to not have a next life, to not become again. Any of these cravings, whether it be for sense pleasures, becoming in this life, becoming in the next life, not becoming in this life, not becoming in the next life, all of these can lead to dukkha. Dukkha arises with craving as a necessary condition. Do you know necessary condition? Like a necessary condition for the light to be on is that the switch be turned on. It's not a sufficient condition. There still have to be the wires that run to the power plant, and the power plant has to be working and sending the electricity here. But if you want to turn off the light, you don't have to go blow up the power plant. You don't even have to cut the wires. Because the switch is a necessary condition, if you can turn off the switch, it turns off the light. The Buddha was quite smart. He recognized that dukkha was the problem. And if he could find a necessary condition for dukkha and turn off that necessary condition, it would turn off the dukkha. And so he found the necessary condition, craving, and that's the second ennobling truth. And the third ennobling truth is if you don't want dukkha, don't crave. Don't allow the necessary condition to arise and you won't get the result. Now, if I tell you, don't crave, can you do that? No. I mean, if the Buddha were sitting here himself and were to tell you, don't crave, it's still not under your control. You find your mind doing all sorts of things that you didn't intend for it to do, like, well, getting lost when you're meditating, but even worse, craving. You actually have to learn to not crave. And this is what the fourth ennobling truth is all about. The path of practice that leads to the end of dukkha by being a path of practice that teaches you how to get beyond craving. These four ennobling truths are like an Ayurvedic medical diagnosis. Ayurvedic medicine is the type of medicine practiced in India at that time and is still practiced today. The first of the ennobling truths is a diagnosis of the disease, dukkha. The second is the cause of the disease, craving. The third is the prognosis. And we get a favorable prognosis. The disease is curable. Stop the craving and the dukkha stops. And the fourth ennobling truth is the prescription, the medicine that needs to be taken. But the prescription is not a piece of paper you take to the pharmacy. It's eight practices to undertake. The first of these practices is right view, is the way it's usually translated, samadhiti. Sama, right, is not a bad translation. It might be better translated as appropriate or the most useful. So the most useful view or appropriate view. And what is appropriate view? Well, it's very interesting because if you take a look at some of the oldest material that's found in the suttas, material that was composed probably fairly early in the Buddha's career, and certainly was put into the form that it's preserved for us very early in the history of Buddhism, there's a collection known as the Sutta Nipata. And the fourth book in that seems to be from the very early years of the Buddha's teaching. And one of the most important themes in that book is not holding to fixed views. It doesn't mean you can't have any view, but that any view that you have should be held lightly. This is actually very important thing to remember. If you're not totally awakened right now, you're going to have to change your mind. You can't stay where you are and get someplace else, right? So whatever your view is now, there's quite the possibility that it's got at least something wrong with it. Because if you had it all correct, you'd be totally awakened. So the most important thing to bring on the spiritual path is an open mind. You're not so much looking for answers as exploring to see what you can find. If you find some answers, don't cling to them. Right? Hold them lightly in your hand. Remember, the spiritual path is about letting go. So if you find something, you need to hold it lightly. Keep an open mind on the spiritual path. So that's one aspect of right view. In other discourses, we find the Buddha saying that right view is the knowledge of dukkha, the knowledge of dukkha arising because of craving, the knowledge of the cessation of dukkha when the craving ceases, and the knowledge of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha's teaching is holographic. Often, when you drill down into one of the teachings and start really exploring it, you find the whole set there. So we start talking about the Four Noble Truths. We get to the Fourth Noble Truth, which is the Eightfold Path. We take a look at the first on the Eightfold Path, and we find the Four Noble Truths again. Notice that the Four Noble Truths are not a cosmological or metaphysical explanation of anything. It's not how the world began or how the world operates at its most basic level. It's simply a statement of the problem, dukkha, and what you need to do about it. It's far more practical. The Buddha wasn't teaching metaphysics. This comes to as a shock to quite a number of people who basically want some explanation of how the world works. And the Buddha wasn't doing that. He said repeatedly, I only teach one thing, dukkha and the end of dukkha. That's it. Not how the world came to be or anything else. So this right view of the Four Noble Truths is more of an orientation rather than an explanation. It's about what to keep in mind as you go through life and try and figure out how to have a better life. Now, in other suttas, we find the Buddha describing right view as dependent origination, paticca-samuppada. Dependent origination is, it's a talk that's going to take more time than we have tonight, for sure. But I will talk about it in some detail later in the course. It's usually described as the 12 links of dependent origination. There are a number of interpretations what it means. We'll take a deep look at those. So now you're thinking, okay, was the Buddha contradicting himself? At one time he's saying it's the Four Noble Truths, another time he's saying it's dependent origination. Well, as Ayakema put it, the Four Noble Truths are dependent origination in telegram style. Of course, we don't have telegrams anymore, so I guess the Four Noble Truths are dependent origination in Twitter style. A short way of keeping some of the most important points of dependent origination in mind. So right view is basically understanding that the problem is dukkha, that you need to find the craving associated with any dukkha you're experiencing and let it go, and you need to practice the Eightfold Path. The second on the Eightfold Path is right intention. And what is right intention? The Buddha says right intentions are intentions of renunciation, intentions of non-ill will, and intentions of harmlessness. Renunciation. That's a very loaded topic. Most people's reaction to renunciation is, get your hands off my stuff. Well, that's our problem. We are inundated with stuff. We have so much stuff that we can't close our closets. If we have a garage, it's full of stuff and we can't put the car in there. Some people have to go down the block and rent a room to put their extra stuff in. Somebody gives you a nice birthday present and you've got to figure out where you're going to put it. Your closets are full, your walls have all the nice artwork hanging on them. And furthermore, we live in a culture that basically is saying, whatever problem you have, buy this stuff. And yet on the spiritual path, it's all about letting go. As lay people, it's true, we do need more than three robes and an alms bowl. Okay? But we don't need to get caught up in the cultural madness of acquiring new stuff all the time. When you acquire something else, it's important to think about, okay, do I really need this? Could the money I'm spending on this thing actually be spent on something better, like maybe going on a retreat? I don't know. We also need to keep in mind that all the stuff that we acquire has to be manufactured. That takes energy. It takes materials that probably are not easily replaced, maybe if it's made of wood, but if it's plastic, well, that comes from, well, not dead dinosaurs, but from plants that are even older than dead dinosaurs. And we're not making a lot of plants that are older than dead dinosaurs these days. So we're using it up for this piece of plastic that we throw away. If it's metal, it had to be dug out of the ground and smelted, and all this other stuff would take energy. Part of renunciation practice for lay people is really bearing in mind the impact of the things that we acquire on the environment. What did it take to make this, and how is it going to be disposed of? We live very much in a throwaway society. You buy something and you use it and you throw it away. Or you buy something and it has a lot of packaging material for you to throw away, and then you use it and then you throw it away. So part of being aware of our environment, part of combating global warming, is renunciation. The things that we can let go of are going to help us on the spiritual path, as well as help us practice renunciation and help us combat the degrading of the environment that seems to be taking place. So the first right intention is the intention to let go, renunciation. The second one is non-ill will, and the third is harmlessness. We could put those positively as love and compassion. As I said last night, we are vastly interconnected. The connections are far deeper than is obvious on the surface. Acting in harmony with those interconnections is acting out of love and compassion, of wishing the best for all the beings that you encounter, and helping out when you encounter anyone who's suffering, who's having a bad day. It's quite interesting to think what your life would be like if the intention behind everything you did was to let go, or be loving, or to be helpful. I mean, what would your actions look like? Well, this is what the Buddha is recommending with the second on the Eightfold Path of right intentions, appropriate intentions. Letting go, loving, being compassionate. These first two on the Eightfold Path are usually said to be the wisdom aspect of the path, and the next three are the ethics, the morality aspect. The first of these is right speech. We talked about avoiding wrong speech last night, avoiding speech that is untrue or harsh or abusive or divisive or gossip or idle chatter. In some of the suttas, the Buddha lists what he considers to be useless conversations. Conversations about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, wars. Food, clothing, drink, beds, garlands, perfumes. Villages, towns, cities, countries. Relatives, carriages. Women or men, heroes, street and well gossip, talk of the departed, useless chatter, speculation about being and non-being. All these things he felt were worthless. Now, kings, ministers, armies, dangers, wars, robbers, that's the 6 o'clock news. I don't know what the news looks like in Finland. I haven't seen TV when I've been here. But in America, at 6 o'clock, they give you a Duca report. Right? Today in Afghanistan, there was serious Duca. And then in Syria, there was even more Duca. And there was some Duca in Iraq. And there was Duca in Africa. And right here in America, we had Duca. And then in Washington, D.C., they tried to pass a law to reduce Duca, but probably it'll make more Duca. And right here in our hometown, we had Duca. we'll be back with the weather. I mean, do you really need a 6 o'clock Dukkha report? Now, it is true, it's important to know what's going on in the world. But how much indulgent in discussion about these things do you need to do? Food, clothing, drinks, beds, garlands, perfumes. If you go to a newsstand, how many magazines are devoted to the latest food, clothing, drinks? Well, maybe not garlands. Necklaces, jewelry, perfumes. Villages, towns, cities, countries. Yeah, traveling's a pretty good thing, but how much discussion of that do you need to do? Especially if you're not going there. Carriages, cars, trains, airplanes. Relatives, oh, that's a good topic. Women or men, always very interesting topics. Heroes, I guess that's like pop stars, sports heroes. I don't know about the culture here in Finland, but in America, it's totally obsessed with celebrities. These people that if you really got to know them, you probably wouldn't find them very interesting at all. But somehow they become a celebrity, and everything they do winds up being discussed. The Buddha says that's useless conversation. Street and well gossip. I guess today that's water cooler gossip. You're at work and you're discussing the latest stuff with your coworkers. All this stuff is not useful in the sense that you're not going to learn anything very helpful from it. Now, it may be that the only way to communicate with someone is to talk about some of these topics. I had a friend at work who was big into sports. His favorite sport was ice hockey. And, I'd go talk to him and we'd talk about sports. Sometimes, though, I could move the conversation to something a little more useful. So, if you're talking about one of these topics of conversation, it's important to know that's what you're doing, and if you find an opening to move the conversation to a higher level, by all means, take it. And then we talked about the truth and not using harsh language and being a peacemaker last night. The next on the Eightfold Path is right action. Right action is defined as not killing living beings, not taking what's not given, not committing sexual misconduct. So in two of the Eightfold Path, we have four of the precepts. You might be wondering about the precept about alcohol and drugs. Well, remember, the Buddha is giving this talk to four guys living on one grain of rice a day. They weren't doing alcohol or drugs. They weren't even doing food. Right? It was only later that he had to come up with a precept on the not taking of intoxicants. And then the last of the morality aspects of the Eightfold Path is right livelihood. And what is right livelihood? Any livelihood that's not wrong livelihood. Okay, so what is wrong livelihood? Wrong livelihood is making a living in any way that involves breaking one of the precepts or encouraging someone to break one of the precepts. So even if you don't drink alcohol, but you work in a liquor store, then you're encouraging other people to break the fifth precept. So basically you want to find a way to make a living that doesn't cause harm to others. There are some wrong livelihoods that are outlined in, I believe, the Vinaya, the stories of the rules for the monks and nuns. Things that are listed are being a slave trader, selling weapons, selling poisons, being a mercenary soldier, being a gambler, because gamblers generally are taking what's not given, being a thief, but any way of making a living that causes harm to others is wrong livelihood. The last three on the Eightfold Path are the concentration aspect. The sixth one is right effort, and right effort is usually defined as the four great efforts. The first effort is to make an arisen, unwholesome state go away. The second is to prevent the arising of an unarisen, unwholesome state. The third is to make an unarisen, wholesome state arise. And the fourth is to make an arisen, wholesome state stick around and come to perfection. I'll give you an example. You're driving on the motorway, and some idiot cuts you off, makes a very dangerous move, and you're starting to scream four-letter words at your windshield. An unwholesome state of mind has arisen, and you recognize it. Okay, this is anger, and the antidote for anger is metta. So you stop saying the four-letter words, and you say, "May you learn to drive. May you arrive safely at your destination." Okay, so you made the arisen, unwholesome state of anger go away. So you continue driving down the motorway, and somebody else cuts you off. And you're just ready to start screaming four-letter words at your windshield, and you recognize, oh, I'm about to have an unwholesome state of mind arise. So instead, may you also learn to drive. May you arrive safely at your destination. So you prevent the arising of the unwholesome state. And you do it by making a wholesome state arise. The metta is a wholesome state. And since it's arisen now, you want to keep it around and bring it to perfection. So do metta for everybody on the motorway. May we all arrive safely at our destination. May we not get caught in a traffic jam. May we all not be stressed out, or however you want to do it. So these are the four right efforts. So the Buddha thought that it was quite important to recognize when you're in an unwholesome state of mind and do something about it. Don't just sit there going, angry. Yep, really angry. Yeah, very, very angry. He wasn't into that. It's like anger. Okay, the opposite of anger is metta. Start doing some metta practice. You'll feel a lot better. It's actually unpleasant to be angry. The seventh on the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is defined as the four establishments of mindfulness. Sometimes you see it translated the four foundations of mindfulness. This is mindfulness of the body, physical body, mindfulness of vedana. Vedana is a Pali word that doesn't have a good English translation. It means your initial categorization of a sensory input. There are only three possibilities. Either you find it pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Sometimes you see vedana translated as feeling, which is literally correct, but feeling in English at least has a sense of emotions, and vedana is not emotions. It's just your reaction of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral to a sensory input. So you hear a nice piece of music, pleasant vedana. Someone scrapes their fingernails down the blackboard, unpleasant vedana. You hear the wind rustling in the trees, maybe a little bit pleasant, maybe neutral. The third foundation is mindfulness of mind states, knowing your state of mind. Are you happy, sad, confused, upset, concentrated, not concentrated? Just simply knowing your state of mind. And the fourth foundation is mindfulness of dharmas. Dharma is a word that has many different meanings. Sometimes it means the teachings of the Buddha. Sometimes it means the truth, with a capital T. Sometimes it means phenomena. And I think that's probably the best translation here. Mindfulness of whatever phenomena you're experiencing, but in particular, and how the Buddha's teachings relate to those phenomena. And then the eighth on the Eightfold Path is Sama Samadhi, appropriate concentration. And what is appropriate concentration? Secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and remains in the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. This is appropriate concentration. So the Buddha defined the eighth of the Eightfold Path as the four jhanas. He clearly felt they were important. Now, when the Buddha had finished giving his talk, he saw that one of those five understood what he was talking about it. This man's name was Kandanya. And the Buddha got quite excited. He said, "You know Kandanya, don't you? You know," which in Pali is something like Anyakadanya. "We owe a great debt of gratitude to Kandanya." Can you imagine? The Buddha gets through with this talk and the five guys go, "So?" But no, Kandanya got it. He got it so well that he understood all that arises also ceases. He attained the first level of awakening, which is called stream entry. I'll talk about the levels of awakening later in the retreat. It was such a momentous thing that Kandanya got it, that the Buddha was convinced people can learn this. And so he stayed on with his five friends and he taught them. And over the next few weeks, one by one, each of them attained the first level of awakening. And then when he knew their minds were fully prepared, he taught them what we usually refer to as the second discourse. The discourse on not self. And at the end of that discourse, all five of them were fully awakened. But we'll have to save that for some other time.